This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Iran nuclear talks still not settled as deadline looms. First official results coming in from Nigeria's presidential election. More disturbing information about the co-pilot who crashed the German Wings airliner. These stories and more coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. Negotiators for six world powers in Iran worked late Monday to try to reach an accord to restrain Tehran's nuclear program. But an agreement is still elusive. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says some difficult issues remain, but negotiators realize they are facing a self-imposed Tuesday midnight deadline. The six world powers, Russia, China, Britain, France, Germany, and the United States, are trying to reach a deal with Iran to keep it from developing a nuclear weapon, or give the world a year or more's notice if it tries. Iran is seeking to end the economic sanctions the United Nations and Western powers have imposed on Tehran. A White House spokesman says the talks are going to go down to the wire. If they reach agreement, a final version of the deal would be due by the end of June. A Saudi airstrike killed at least 45 people in a refugee camp in northern Yemen Monday. Humanitarian workers say civilians are among the casualties. The rebel-controlled state-run media say women and children were killed, but Saudi officials say they cannot confirm exactly what happened. The airstrike was apparently targeting a nearby Houthi rebel military installation. Stability in Yemen continues to deteriorate as a Saudi-led coalition stages airstrikes against rebels advancing on government-held positions in the south. VOA's Scott Bobb reports.
The offensive by Iran-backed rebels in Yemen has galvanized into action a Saudi-led coalition of 10 primarily Sunni Arab states. Shiite-led Iran denies it is backing the rebels, whose advances led to the creation of an Arab Rapid Intervention Force. An analyst with Tel Aviv's Institute for National Security Studies, Yoel Guzansky, says Arab states would rather the U.S. or European governments take the lead in countering the conflict in Yemen, but in the absence of a response by the world powers, they feel they must act to protect their interests.
Yemen is important not because of Yemen, but because it's another a place where Arabs fight Persians, where Sunni fight Shias. It's another pawn on the chessboard of the Middle East.
Analysts say the Arab states are increasingly worried about the conflicts in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen, where groups backed by Iran are gaining strength and where power vacuums are being exploited by Islamist militants. Analysts say the likelihood of a military victory in Yemen is slim, and the Saudi-led strikes could draw an Iranian response in Yemen or through their allies elsewhere. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Nigeria's Electoral Commission is issuing results from the country's presidential election, giving an early lead to the main opposition challenger, Muhammadu Buhari. The commission Monday announced official vote totals from at least 13 states and the capital, Abuja. Mr. Buhari won 10 states, while President Goodluck Jonathan was the winner in 3 states and the federal capital territory. Some of Mr. Buhari's victories came in states in southern Nigeria, which is generally considered a stronghold for President Jonathan. Sierra Leone's 3-day lockdown is over. People were told to stay at home across the country, while volunteers went door-to-door educating people on Ebola intervention and encouraging sick people to seek treatment. Nina DeVries has more.
Many officials are referring to this massive shutdown as a zero Ebola campaign. The goal is to stop the spread of the disease, explained Roland Monash from UNICEF, one of the partners in the campaign. It was also involved in a previous shutdown last September when people were also told to stay at home and volunteers moved around, raising awareness. Mary Cargbo was one of those people. She's a nurse and was one of the 25,000 volunteers doing the door-to-door awareness. She hopes this will make a difference in the long run.
Some people up till now, they did the things they did not supposed to do.
Okay.
Because by right, when they said we should not keep any sick people in the house.
The virus is spread through direct contact with bodily fluids, and people washing dead bodies has been a big problem in increasing transmission. Almost 4,000 people have died in Sierra Leone from Ebola. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Across West Africa, more than 10,000 people have died from Ebola. President Barack Obama is planning to visit his ancestral homeland of Kenya in what would be his first visit there as president. Mr. Obama will go to Kenya at the end of July to attend the Global Entrepreneurship Summit. The White House says the exact dates are not confirmed, and there's no word on whether Mr. Obama plans to see family members while in Kenya. A British man pleaded guilty in federal court in New York to charges of trying to set up an al-Qaeda terrorist training camp in rural Oregon in the U.S. Northwest. Haroon Aswad faces up to 20 years in prison when he is sentenced at a later date. Aswad came to the U.S. from Britain in 2009. He and two co-defendants conspired to stockpile weapons and train other Muslims in acts of terrorism at a camp they planned to set up in Oregon. One person was killed and two others were injured Monday after federal police opened fire on an unauthorized car trying to access a U.S. military compound near Washington. The National Security Agency says security officials shot at a vehicle carrying two men dressed as women after the driver accelerated toward a police car guarding the Fort Meade complex where the intelligence agency is headquartered. An occupant of the rogue vehicle died at the scene. Another was transported to a local hospital, as was a police officer with non-life-threatening injuries. The FBI, which is leading the investigation, tells VOA it does not believe the incident is related to terrorism. French prosecutors say the German wing's co-pilot, accused of intentionally crashing his plane into the Alps, had suicidal tendencies in the past, but appeared to be stable. The German wing's Airbus crashed into the French Alps last Tuesday, killing all 150 people on board. French officials say the plane's flight recorders indicate the co-pilot Andreas Lubitz locked the pilot out of the cockpit before deliberately setting the plane on course to slam into the mountainside. Prosecutors say they have not yet found any motive for his action. South African Trevor Noah was selected to become the next host of The Daily Show, which is shown on the cable television network Comedy Central. The 31-year-old comedian will replace Jon Stewart, who has hosted the show for 16 years. Noah has hosted numerous television shows, including his own late-night talk show in South Africa, Tonight with Trevor Noah. No official date for Noah's debut or Stewart's departure has been disclosed. And that's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
I'm Jim Stevenson with business news from the Voice of America. U.S. stocks climbed more than 1% Monday, rebounding from a sharp decline last week, helped by deal activity in healthcare and a bounce in energy shares. Also boosting investors' risk appetite, Chinese stocks surging to seven-year highs, helped by hopes for more infrastructure spending and monetary policy easing. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 263 points. That's almost a 1.5% increase to finish at 17,976. The S&P 500 gained 25 points. It now sits at 2086. And the NASDAQ Composite adding 56 points to its total, which now stands at 4947. European stocks rose in the most in almost 3 weeks, poised for their best quarter since 2009. Amid optimism, central banks will continue to support global growth. The stock's Europe 600 index rose 1.1%. It's at 399.84 at the close of trading, extending gains after data showed pending sales of U.S. homes rose more than forecast in February. The benchmark gauge on Friday trimmed its worst weekly loss of the year, buoyed by healthcare shares. It's now up 17% for 2015. McDonald's Corporation is introducing table service in Germany as it reinvents itself as a modern progressive burger company under its new chief executive, Steve Easterbrook. Diners at its Frankfurt Airport restaurant in Germany, one of the company's toughest markets, will now be able to be served at their table after placing an order either at the front counter, a digital kiosk, or with a waiter carrying a tablet PC. The new service offered to guests at the reopening after renovation of the restaurant It has more than 500 seats. That's Business News. Well, coming up on VOA Global, Don Draper and his fictional 1960s ad agency are about to close the doors on a widely popular cable TV series. David Byrd sets up for us the final season of Mad Men on today's edition of Now. But first, so much has been written about U.S. civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., who was assassinated more than 50 years ago. Perhaps one of the most interesting perspectives from the family's personal driver. We'll hear next.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. In 1966, Tom Houck was a volunteer in Alabama and Mississippi, helping organize demonstrations and registering African Americans to vote. The white high school dropout was 18 years old. An invitation to Sunday lunch with Dr. Martin Luther King and his family led to a job driving Dr. King's children to school as a personal assistant to the family. He got to know the Kings and Atlanta intimately. Now, almost five decades later, Houck is driving again. He's organized bus tours taking Atlanta visitors to places where prominent African Americans and civil rights leaders lived, worked, and played. Houck showed reporter Philip Grazer some of the highlights of the tour.
Tom Houck's civil rights tour of Atlanta begins at the city's new Civil and Human Rights Center. He explains that when he moved here in 1966, Atlanta was the hub of America's civil rights movement.
This was ground zero for the strategy of what was going to happen in Alabama, Mississippi, Selma, Montgomery, Birmingham, Albany, Georgia. This was the place where the leaders lived. This was the place the strategy was made.
Houck's tour leads out of downtown to a neighborhood called Vine City. This is one of Atlanta's roughest areas. But the homes on one street are well-maintained. At one time, several of Atlanta's black clergy and professionals lived here. We stop in front of a modest two-story red brick house.
This is the house that Dr. King would come back from when he was traveling out and play with the kids in the front yard, play basketball in the backyard. In that garage right there is still one of the cars that I actually drove.
We turn onto what used to be Hunter Street, but is now called Martin Luther King Drive, and stop in front of a small gray stone church.
It's called West Hunter Street Baptist Church. That church is very historic in many ways because there were several strategic meetings after on Selma and Birmingham that happened in this church.
Down the street is a vacant restaurant and hotel.
In Pascal's, this is history. This is where people would organize the first major political campaigns in Atlanta.
But now, like many of the buildings along Martin Luther King Drive, Pascal's has been boarded up and abandoned. On Atlanta's east side is Southview Cemetery. Founded in 1886, it offered Atlanta's African Americans an alternative to burial in segregated cemeteries.
This is probably the most famous African American cemetery in America. This was the place that was Dr. King's first resting place after his funeral. His father and mother both are buried here, Daddy King and Alberta King. There is row after row of famous Atlantans who built the black community in Atlanta that are buried at the cemetery.
A short drive brings us back to central Atlanta.
We're on Auburn Avenue. This was, without question, the center of the black community in Atlanta. And it was from this street where great power in terms of politics and in terms of social change took place.
Martin Luther King grew up on this street, which boasted churches, clubs, restaurants, and dozens of small businesses. They're gone now, but the street is being revitalized. It's become a National Historic Site, commemorating the civil rights leader and his works. Ebenezer Baptist Church, where King preached, is here. Replicas of King's Bible and his Nobel Peace Prize are on display at the King Center. A white marble crypt containing the remains of Dr. King and his wife Coretta sits in the middle of a reflecting pool. But Houck says the contributions of many of the people and places important to the civil rights movement are overlooked.
I looked around Atlanta over the last couple of years and realized that so much of the civil rights history of this town has not really been accurately portrayed in a way that people from around the world will know how important this town was.
Houck hopes his tour will change that. For VOA News, I'm Philip Grazer in Atlanta.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Join us on VOA Global and as a podcast on many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. This week, the final episodes of the multiple award-winning period drama Mad Men begin airing in the United States. The show is set in a 1960s fictional advertising agency and has received widespread acclaim for its historical authenticity, its visual beauty, the costumes, the acting, the scripts, and the directing. It has won 15 Emmys in total, including taking the Emmy for Outstanding Drama Series 4 years in a row. It has also won 4 Golden Globes. The series focuses on the life and relationships of Don Draper, the creative director at the ad agency, first known as Sterling Cooper, and then as Sterling Cooper Draper Price. The series has covered such poignant moments in American history as the assassinations of John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr., the beginnings of the Vietnam War, and the moon landing. John Hamm plays Don Draper and says that his enigmatic nature, his real name is Dick Whitman, he assumed Don Draper's identity when the real Draper was killed in the Korean War, is part of what draws audiences.
I think that that's part of the attraction of the character. I think that's part of what people find intriguing and compelling about not only the story, but their relationship to the character and to the and the character's relationship to the larger world that he's set in.
The series has used the time period of the 1960s to look at several modern issues, including sexism, alcoholism, racism, women's rights, and others. Don Draper and Roger Sterling, played by John Slattery, have an on-screen chemistry of two men at the height of their powers, even though both men have real difficulties with alcohol and with their relationships. The final 7 episodes will start airing April 5th. Hamm has done other projects outside Mad Men, including the Disney movie Million Dollar Arm. The actor says it is strange to be talking to the media about the end of Mad Men because the cast wrapped the show almost a year ago.
It will be, I think, interesting to see everyone's reaction, which I hope is positive, and hope people are satisfied and intrigued and but it will also be reliving a very long journey for us.
John Hamm says that it might be tough for the public to think of him as someone other than Don Draper because the show has become ingrained in American culture.
You know, people identify, you know, me and, as this person a lot. And so part of that is being, you know, is having a presence in comedy and being goofy and... Part of it is, you know, doing other things. And I've been incredibly fortunate to have the opportunity to do that. A lot of people don't get it.
Mad Men has become so influential that some of the props, including Don Draper's hat, suit, and trench coat, and the drinking cart from his office, have been installed in the Smithsonian's Museum of American History. Show creator Matthew Weiner said it's very gratifying to have the more than 50 artifacts be part of the museum's collection.
And the idea of recreating a piece of culture that is that recent where such a huge chunk of your audience has lived through it and the artifacts still exist in real life, it's gratifying to glorify the average person and to talk about the way we live.
Some of the props on display include a pack of Lucky Strike cigarettes, some liquor bottles, Vicks cough drops, and chocolate Ex-Lax packages. Dwight Blocker Bowers is the curator of entertainment at the museum, and he said the show got all the little details right.
What stands out most to me is Don Draper's suit, because that typifies the early 1960s for the hat and the trench coat. I mean, that literally comes out of the movies. That looks to me like movies looked in the 1960s. The show is beautiful for making everything period accurate in their advertising, down to the cigarettes, down to the liquor bottles. The labels are absolutely accurate for the early 1960s.
The exhibition, called American Enterprise, will focus on the history of business and branding. It opens to the public July 1st. So are you a Mad Men fan? Let us know by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia, or send us an email to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
A 4-year-old Philadelphia girl woke up in the middle of the night and was hungry. Now, that's not news, but her odyssey to find a snack is. The little girl slipped out of her house at 3 in the morning and then boarded a local transit bus. Bus driver Harlan Jennifer said the girl swung her legs as she chanted, "All I want is a slushie." Surveillance video showed the preschooler sitting on the bus chatting to other passengers. Jennifer stopped the bus, called police, who reunited her with her parents. This is Sports on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. John Calipari, of course, is the coach of the Kentucky Wildcats. Earlier this year, he invited National Basketball Association scouts and general managers to a first-of-its-kind workout before the start of the season. That's so they could get a look at what all of his future pros on his team could do. Calipari also wanted some feedback about his players, and then he shut the doors for the season on all the NBA scouts and refocused his players on the task at hand. Well, the dividends have been flowing ever since. The Wildcats are just 2 wins away from the first perfect season since the 1975-1976 season. 3 Kentucky players you'll want to watch, Karl Anthony Towns, Willie Cauley-Stein, and Trey Lyles, are projected as top 20 draft picks should they go pro. Kentucky is in the Final Four of the National Men's College Basketball National Championship Tournament, along with Wisconsin, Duke, and Michigan State. They will all tip off for the final push this weekend in Indianapolis, Indiana. Well, listen to this. It's a loud story from the National Football League, which has fined the Atlanta Falcons and stripped the organization of a draft pick and suspended team president Rich McKay from the league's competition committee, all because the team used fake noise at home games. In a statement released Monday, the league announced the Falcons have been fined $350,000, will forfeit their 5th-round selection in the 2016 draft, and if the Falcons have multiple picks in that round, the highest selection will be forfeited. The National Football League noted throughout the 2013 season and on into the 2014 season, the Falcons violated league rules that state at no point during the game can artificial crowd noise or amplified crowd noise be played in the stadium. Probably be a little quieter at future games. Well, in the glassy offices of Boston's headquarters for bidding on the 2024 Olympics, there are signs that read, "Keep calm and bid on." The bad days have seemingly far outweighed the good since Boston was chosen in January over Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Washington as the U.S. candidate to host the Summer Games in 2024. It would be the first Summer Games in the United States since Atlanta in 1996. That's sports on the Voice of America.
Ballet companies everywhere are aggressively trying to stay relevant as they seek new audiences. Canada's Alberta Ballet is among the foremost in bringing the avant-garde to its stage. This year's new season will feature pop ballets based on the songbooks of singer-songwriters Elton John and Bernie Taupin, as well as the award-winning sounds of Katie Lang. Alberta Ballet's production, Love Lies Bleeding, is based on some of Elton and Bernie's best. Saturday Night's All Right was a big hit for Elton John and Bernie Taupin, and still a part of Elton's playlist when he's out on the road performing to packed houses. We'll be right back. Katie Lang is a native of Canada. She says she never thought her music would be the subject of a ballet in Canada or anywhere.
I'm a little vulnerable to begin with, as I'm walking into a ballet written on my music in my life.
Appearing on Canadian Broadcasting, Lang said the ballet featuring her songs, such as Constant Cravings, is something really different for her.
It's kind of raw, it's kind of vulnerable, and, you know, there's a lot of people looking at me and expecting me to react. Maybe a great magnet pulls also.
Yeah, it's so interesting to have someone create a story based on all the composite stories of mine.
The Alberta Ballet Company's production featuring Lang's music is titled Balleluia. It's a takeoff on Katie's hit cover of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah.
I heard there was a secret chord David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, a fourth, a fifth, a minor fall, a major left, a baffled king composing Hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
As ballet companies try to keep their fans and find more, there is already proof that the Alberta Ballet, doing ballets based on pop themes, can go a long way in making that happen. That's Music on VOA Global. I'm Steve Norman.
Light overthrew you. Well, she tied you to her kitchen chair, broke your throne and cut your hair.
Well, you may know that here in the United States, each individual state has a symbol to help identify itself. In fact, they have many different symbols that they've adopted over the years. But when New Hampshire lawmakers this month shot down as frivolous a group of fourth graders' efforts to name the red-tailed hawk as the official state raptor, well, the elected representatives got pasted as insensitive bullies. But in a state with an official tree, bird, dog, animal, insect, amphibian, butterfly, saltwater fish, freshwater fish, rock, mineral, gem, even a tartan, some legislators say, well, they've got a point. Maybe instead they should tackle things like budgets, taxes, and education. Well, New Hampshire's list of official tokens is far from the lengthiest. Oklahoma has 45 state symbols, including five separate state foods, including the state bean, black-eyed peas, six separate meals, including chicken fried steak. There were more than 70 pieces of legislation nationwide this year, many of them brought by students engaged in a civics lesson, to name everything from the official Alaska state hostess to the official legendary creature in Wyoming. That, of course, is the jackalope. Massachusetts has 9 bills to name symbols this year, including the official Tai Chi form. All of this apparently came from the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, which inspired states to adopt official floral emblems and kicked off this trend of naming stuff for their states. Interesting. Well, our name is VOA Global, and we hope you join us again tomorrow. Director Tracy Carter, engineer Zahrat Abuzaid, and managing editor Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson. Join us tomorrow.